Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Tuesday, everyone. This is Melissa Biliardi, and this is the Ask Dr. Goodman Show. Tonight, our call-in numbers are 310-982-4227 or 877-497-4103. When you press 1, we'll cue you into the show, and thank you, 95,000 listeners, for tuning in to Help for HD Radio. We now have 220 archived episodes for you to refer back to and send out to your family and fellow caregivers and friends. Tonight is a very special show with Dr. Goodman. It marks our 40th show together. I bet you didn't know that, Dr. Goodman. I'm so proud and appreciative that Dr. Goodman has dedicated herself to doing these shows with me and for all of you, always bringing credible, practical, and useful information to our Huntington's disease community. So thank you, Dr. Goodman, so much. Tonight we'll be talking about Dr. Goodman's recent article, Antipsychotics and Tetrabenazine, More Rapid Progression of HD? And Dr. Goodman writes, in a recent publication in the Journal for Huntington's Disease, Tedroff and collaborators report that antipsychotic and tetrabenazine drugs were associated with more rapid progression of Huntington's disease. And so we're going to be talking about that tonight. And Dr. Goodman, how are you? And welcome to your 40th show.
Oh, my. I'm still 39, you know. Aren't we all? Yeah.
So, yeah, great.
No.
Yeah. So this is a very interesting article.
Yep. It is troubling, I think, but it's also, and before I talk about the troubling portions of it, whenever a study is done and they are able to see that, when you look at some factor in a study, when you're looking at a lot of people, and you see that, and then you pick a drug or something that these people may be on, and then you see, how they did. How did those people do in terms of, and you could, use whatever measurement you want, and see if, people on that drug did better or worse than, the rest of the people in the study who weren't on those drugs. And this is, and they actually showed for a certain classes of drugs that functional capacity got worse faster when people were taking antipsychotics or tetrabenazine. Now, that one thing you have to remember is that doesn't mean that the drugs caused it. They didn't show that. What they because perhaps the people who needed to be on or were on these drugs had a more severe type of the disease, and it would have gone faster anyway. So it's associated with, but not necessarily causing it.
Right.
And there's a difference.
So association versus cause is two different things, right?
Right. You can't sort that out from this particular study. But I think one of the other things they looked at, I think this is the first study that suggests that, first report that suggests that registry or now enroll HD, if you study, you take everybody's information that's enroll over time, you may be able to find factors that indeed are more helpful or harmful to Huntington's. And so that's actually part of the CARE initiative of a CARE component of the enroll study. I may not have said that clearly. You know, it's Enroll is a registry and a research platform and helps with clinical trial recruitment, but it's also, there is hope that by inputting all of this, getting all the information in there and what drugs people are on and what therapies that they're getting, over time and with good analysis programs, they may be able to find some factors that are helpful, more helpful to Huntington's, and also, you know, and push those to be used to improve quality of care. Or we might, as in this case, maybe you'll find something that is actually worsening disease, and then limiting the use of those drugs in that situation, it will might be helpful. So it's a way of looking at another way of looking at Enroll as being helpful in care, even if a clinical trial, you know, taking the research component out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That makes
sense
there.
Can we talk about, yes, absolutely. But I wanted to ask you some questions about dopamine in Huntington's disease. What does it do? And, I mean, everybody has dopamine, right? I mean, receptors. So what happens with Huntington's and dopamine?
Well, dopamine is a critical neurotransmitter in all different parts of the brain. You know, without it, then you develop, then a person, if you take dopamine, let's look at Parkinson's disease. That is a disease that is more clearly, both Huntington's and Parkinson's are certainly have lots of dopamine problems. But if you thought of Parkinson's, and it's not as simple as this, but as a dopamine deficiency, what it does is it slows movement, it slows thinking, it slows the neuroprocessing in the brain. And Huntington's certainly has that also. But Huntington's also has the hyper movements. It has the chorea and the dystonia. So it's more complicated in a sense than the dopamine system is more complicated in Huntington's than Parkinson's probably. I may be oversimplifying here, but it's a way of thinking about it. There are systems, whenever we move our hand, move our arm, there's an action component to that, a voluntary action. We want to move our hand, and dopamine is working there to stimulate nerves that, in a cascade, helps move our hand. You want to move your hand towards a certain object to do something, so you want to be able to stop that movement too. And so there will be both action and inhibition of action in different circuits. And there's an imbalance, it's thought, and again, I'm oversimplifying for those any scientists out there listening, that there's an imbalance between both the voluntary, or, you know, getting your hand to where it should go, and then being able to stop it. There are involuntary movements that individuals with Huntington's can't stop. I mean, they can really override it by trying, but if they're not really trying, they'll have involuntary movement.
Would that be from too much dopamine?
Well, it's actually probably... It's dysregulated, so there may be too much dopamine action in certain spots and then too little in others. Dopamine receptors, there are a bunch of different, there are many different receptors on cells that dopamine interact with. And the ones that, and those receptors decrease over time in individuals with Huntington's disease.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly an important one, the B2 receptor. And they're all important, and they do different things.
Right.
But they decrease. They go away. Instead of having, 10 receptors on a cell, and it's a lot more than that, it will have 2.
Mm-hmm.
Or something like that. So there's a decrease mm-hmm. in number of receptors. So no matter, even if there is the same amount of dopamine, you're not going to have the same action.
Mm-hmm. So how does the dopamine work, or the anti-dopamine drugs
tetrabenazine actually works by depleting dopamine. So mm-hmm. it doesn't let it be reabsorbed, and so it gets metabolized or destroyed. So it actually, mm-hmm. there's less dopamine available when a person's on tetrabenazine. The antipsychotics work a different way. They block the receptor that causes the action.
Mm-hmm.
So they both, you can think of them as being opposing dopamine action.
Mm-hmm.
And so both of them are used for chorea, both the tetrabenazine or xenazine and mm-hmm. The antipsychotics are both chorea treatments.
And that goes for the Haldol and Zyprexa as well.
Right. Haldol okay. is what's called a first generation antipsychotic, or one of the earlier ones that was made.
Mm-hmm.
And they are a stronger dopamine blocker than are the second generation or the newer antipsychotics like Zyprexa, or like Abilify is even newer.
Mm-hmm.
And the newer ones tend to be less purely blocking of dopamine receptors.
Mm-hmm. So there may be a gentler form of anti-dopamine?
Well, there's a lot of argument amongst the experts about that, but mm-hmm. I think the majority, particularly of psychiatrists, neuropsychiatrists, would say that that is so.
Mm-hmm.
That
okay,
maybe
well,
it's a little easier on those dopamine receptors.
Yeah. I want to talk about the study a little bit more, too, because this was a 2-year time interval based on your on your article. Were the CAG repeats part of the study? I mean, did they have anything to do with the study, or?
Well, what the authors tried to do, they had about 600 people, and half were on these drugs and half were not. And the authors jumped through hoops to try to eliminate those other factors that might have gone along to cause this. They tried to eliminate those. They looked at them. They looked at CAG counts. They looked at age. They looked at disease burden. They jumped through hoops. Different analyses to try to sort that out, and came to the conclusion that they didn't find that was imparting any major component to it at all. So mm-hmm. they subtracted that out, in other words.
And then were there controls in this study too?
Well, you mean this was a retrospective study? Which
okay.
means you, and it's hard to do a prospective one, or because you, well, let me back up. Retrospective means they looked at this data after it was already in there. They looked,
mm-hmm.
they looked at it, they chose a point in time, and they looked at, people then, and then they, mm-hmm. they looked at the data that was in there already from, 2 years ago. And now, and then, mm-hmm. and then they did their analysis. So, people were, you know, it isn't like you put, you know, people came into the study and then you put half of them on the drugs and then half you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a prospective one. And
okay.
If that were the case and everything else was balanced in the beginning, then you could have some causal, potentially have more causal information.
Mm-hmm.
What you don't know based on this study, because it was retrospective, you don't know if that the two people were otherwise equal that were on the drugs and not on the drugs. You don't know what their disease progression had been prior.
Right.
So it may have been that those people who were on the drugs were on it because they needed it, because they had a faster disease progression to start with. So they couldn't sort that out with this kind of study.
Right.
But they did their best to eliminate anything that seemed to have bearing on that. For instance, disease burden, age of onset of symptom and, figuring in age of onset and CAG repeat number. So they did a bunch of things like that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So then why is dosing so important with these types of drugs?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Why is making sure that the dosing is correct for these drugs?
Well, I mean, the assumption is that if these drugs are causing problems with disease progression, the lower dose that you can use might be better. They didn't show that people who were on higher doses did worse. You would probably need a lot more numbers of people to study to show that. So that wasn't discussed. I don't know if they looked at it or not. You know, one of the things, and when I summarize this, I say, you know, what this tells us gives us more reason not to use antipsychotics unless we really need them.
Exactly.
In other words, and that should have been the case in the beginning. You know, if you can treat irritability adequately with a drug that has fewer side effects, then don't use an antipsychotic. If you need this because a person is aggressive and threatening, well, then the benefit of being on an antipsychotic is greater than the risk of not being on it. Excuse me. The benefit is great enough that the risk is accepted.
Right.
As it would be with a psychotic symptom. But again, using the lower dosage almost always gives you smaller side effects.
Mm-hmm.
And so a smaller dosage, if it's an effective dosage, is what you should always use, because you want to subtract some of that risk.
Does the nature of antidopamine medications cause patients to need an increase to control symptoms or address symptoms, or can you keep it at a specific dose throughout?
It should be based on symptom severity.
Okay.
Does a lower dose control the symptom adequately? You should go always with the lowest dose of a medication that controls the symptom adequately.
Mm-hmm.
And adequately is at a level that is satisfactory, you know, to the patient, to the family, depending on the symptom. It can change over time with an individual. Often with, you know, disease progression, a person who has bothersome chorea, the need for an antipsychotic, a need for a drug for chorea should decrease as the, as the disease advances, as the stage advances. So there is decreasing antipsychotics. There should always be a trial of doing that as a person progresses.
Is that also true with tetrabenazine?
Chorea, on average, most people who have chorea at the middle stage of their disease, will decrease in late stage. So there is should not be need for as much of the medication in later stage disease for chorea. And what happens too often is it isn't decreased. You know, it gets started by the specialist for treating the chorea adequately, ever how you define adequately, and then that person, as the disease advances, it's harder for them to get into the specialist, so they don't see the specialist, and then they're kept on medications that the specialist put the individual on originally,
right,
even if they don't need them. And I who see people in the community who are in family homes or have a great deal of difficulty getting out to go to specialty centers, I see this more often than you might think. Well, you probably think I would see it often, and yes, I do. And trying to taper that medication off is always good, because these medications, while they slow down the things like chorea, also slow down the Parkinsonian-like symptoms that Huntington's individuals have. So swallowing gets slower, so there's more choking. The walking is slower. The, you know, how quickly a person can move, how quickly a person can think is impaired by antipsychotics. There is an earlier study out of France that suggests that the first generation, or the older antipsychotics like Haldol, interfere with cognition more and also are associated with more apathy than the second generation or the newer antipsychotics.
Interesting. So now what if the chorea increases? Then is the dosage increased or decreased?
If the chorea increases?
Yes.
If chorea is at a point where the benefits for treating it are there, you know, the person's injuring themselves with the very wide movements, or it's causing people to lose their balance and fall more. And a lot of chorea can certainly do that. So if the symptoms warrant, you know, treating it more, yes. Again, it's the risk. It's the benefit and risk ratio. Is the symptom more dangerous to the person than the drug? And if so, then it warrants treatment as carefully as can be done. You don't, you know, the goal is not to get rid of chorea, because when you do that, you've used too much. And you're also slowing down the slow parts of Huntington's way too much. The way I look at it in terms of treating chorea is, if that person, when they're relaxed, you know, watching, sitting in a chair, watching TV, doesn't have troubling movement, that's the degree of chorea that should be treated.
Mm-hmm.
Not the degree of chorea when someone's upset or when they're excited,
mm-hmm.
When other things are happening around them that have them, you know, interacting either excitedly, then that isn't the degree of chorea that you should treat. It's when they're relaxed,
right.
The baseline chorea, not the one that's affected by things going around outside of them.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, why do you suppose that some individuals don't have chorea?
Well, of course, there's less chorea in juvenile onset, and there's less chorea in older age onset, too. I don't know why. I don't think the experts know why, that the imbalance in dopamine is different in those two different settings than it is that those who have middle age onset of Huntington's tend to have more chorea. But there are many people who don't have a lot of chorea, even if they have middle age
mm-hmm.
onset. So there are lots of different factors that have to be working besides just CAD counts and age of onset. And I don't know why, and I don't think our experts know why. It has to be related to other things going on in that person's cell and genome.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a
blood test to determine the level of dopamine? Or receptors, or any condition of the dopamine receptors?
There isn't a blood test, but there's certain imaging studies where dopamine receptors can be quantitated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it do they is and that's there've been such things for a decade or more, probably more.
Mm-hmm. Are they utilizing
that measured for
Huntington's?
I think they are. It can be used at least in earlier stage disease as a marker of disease progression. And it's
mm-hmm.
very much related to tapping speed.
Interesting.
And, you know, there are different dopamine receptors, so there are different ways to measure the different ones.
My goodness, I had no idea about that one. I would imagine that would be helpful for drug trials, right?
It is potentially helpful. It is one marker that tends to go along with disease progression. Has it been validated as a marker of disease progression to use in a clinical trial? No. You know, none of those things. Nothing has been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in clinical trials now, in the SIGNAL study, you know, they are using not just volumetric or MRIs. They are utilizing PET scans to measure different functions within the cell in hopes that that can be a biomarker for that drug's effectiveness. So it is, you know, these things are being studied and now it's being used in clinical trial too. In the PG-10 inhibitor that Pfizer is studying, they have also a marker that they can use to give them an idea of how much drug interaction is going on. So
mm-hmm.
this sort of thing as being, it's not a dopamine receptor, it's a different receptor. But so these things are being studied and even used in those two clinical trials.
Fantastic. Okay, let's talk about, you wanted, you had a take-home message, and I think it's really important that we talk about this because otherwise it could be controversial, you know,
yeah,
as far as association and cause.
Is that though it's not definitive, the study is worrisome regarding the use of this type of drug. And if the drug isn't needed, you know, it's like, you know, you have if you have a cancer, you know, if you don't have a cancer, you don't want to use a cancer drug because it will be toxic for you. If you have a cancer, well, then, though it's a risky drug, it may give you no more benefit than risk. So if you have a severe symptom that warrants treatment, you know, your doctor and you decide that this symptom is really bothersome, this symptom is, you know, is interfering with your life a lot, then using a drug that may have a safety concern, you need to balance the risk against the benefit, or the benefit against the risk. So don't use an antipsychotic for some symptoms that's worrisome, that a drug with fewer side effects will work just fine. For irritability that isn't aggressive or threatening, use an SSRI. Perhaps even use a mood stabilizer. An anti-epileptic drug like Valproate or Depakote, Tegretol, those kinds of drugs can also help with, you know, mood instability and tendency for aggressive or agitated behaviors. They can help. Also, they have their side effects also, but perhaps they're a little safer. Now, this, of course, hasn't been studied. I can't say this for sure, but they're perhaps a little safer than the antipsychotics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you give a person with schizophrenia an antipsychotic, and you scan them, you do MRIs, you will find that certain parts of the brain get smaller.
Hmm.
And if you use a first-generation drug, it's a little different than using a second-generation drug, where the smaller size of the brain is in a different place. You know, what does that mean?
Can you explain what is the difference? I mean, what is first-generation and second-generation drug? You said that a couple times, so I don't know.
Okay, first-generation. And there's not a clear distinction between the two, first of all. First generation means that these were the first drugs that were used for schizophrenia.
Okay,
drugs
got it.
Like flucinazine or Haldol, these were used, you know, a generation ago.
Okay, got it.
Mm-hmm. And they treated schizophrenia very well. However, they had some side effects, and it's although there is disagreement amongst experts still, the newer ones, the one that, you know, were ones that were developed a decade later, were thought to have fewer side effects, the tardive dyskinesia. Seem to be happen more frequently in the first generation drugs. Now there's some argument about this, although most psychiatrists now will prescribe the second generation drugs because they believe there are fewer side effects. And they believe there are fewer side effects because you're not the newer drugs tend to have action at more than the dopamine receptor. They're hitting other receptors too, so you don't have to have as much dopamine blockage. That's the theory. Again, people disagree about this. The experts disagree, but psychiatrists, the vast majority are using second-generation drugs. They are the experts on, I believe, antipsychotics and probably know more about it than medical people or neurologists do because they use them more often. So I tend to believe the psychiatrists on this one.
Mm-hmm. And tardive dyskinesia, is that a movement as well, movement disorder as well?
It is, and it's sometimes hard to tell from some of the later movements of Huntington's. The mouth smacking is a, and drooling can be a part of tardive dyskinesia, and this is what happened, in young schizophrenics who were prescribed these first-generation drugs in fairly high dosages. This would be a more common side effect.
Okay. Is that a permanent side effect, or is that something that will go away after the drug is discontinued?
It is variable. Sometimes it doesn't go away.
Okay. Interesting. Have you ever heard of any physicians prescribing tetrabenazine for dystonia?
I have not. You're talking about primary dystonia and not the dystonia of Huntington's. Which one are you talking about?
I saw it somewhere, and I think it was on on a dystonia website that they were using tetrabenazine. But I would imagine it's probably primary.
Yeah, and I believe that they are using that off-label, and there may be a clinical trial also. At least they were thinking about doing it, and I don't follow that literature closely enough to know to answer that question correctly. The dystonic movements that happen in Huntington's, Korea. In many individuals will change character a bit over the course of the disease. And at the more towards later stages, the chorea will, or the movements will be more, I call it dystonic in nature. The movements are wider, more ballistic than perhaps the smaller jerky movements of earlier chorea. And in my experience, treating that as chorea has not been helpful. Using a tetrabenazine drug has not been helpful. But that is not, that's my one experience. And I had actually asked Dr. Ondo about that, who has used tetrabenazine a lot, and he was of the same opinion. That's just a personal communication. Has this been studied? I don't think so. A couple of people say, no, it doesn't work because I tried it and it doesn't work, doesn't necessarily mean that that's true.
Right.
But using these drugs in later stage disease when there's already the slowness of movement, the swallowing problems, the falling, you can make the gait worse by using these anti-dopaminergic drugs. So backing off on them in later stage, I think, is very important because you can't tell what's the disease and what's the medication. And if there's a chance that the medication's doing it, then get it off or decrease it the best that you can.
And what should we do if we think that our loved one is needing to have his medication decreased and just have the physician address it, go directly to the physician? What if they're in a facility or something like that.
You wouldn't do it by yourself. Would, say, I've heard that I might not, that this drug may have some side effects. Do I really need it, or is there something else that could be substituted? And there might not be. But again, if the drug is needed, it's needed. And there's a greater risk of stopping it. This study doesn't for sure prove it, that it's bad for you. It's worrisome that it might be. So if you don't need to be on this drug, get off of it or decrease it. It is the take-home message.
I would hope that if they don't need to be on it, that they aren't on it already, right?
Well, what happens with Huntington's is antipsychotics, I believe, have always been overprescribed because a lot of people are taken care of by generalists who have not been taught about anything about Huntington's except that Haldol works.
Yeah.
Or that's the take-home message that they got at the end of their 1 hour or 2 hours of training in Huntington's. It's not their fault that they don't know it because they were never taught it and they don't know where to learn it. It's not so easy to learn it, to find the sources to learn how to manage this very complex disease. And that's why centers are very important. It's also why centers should do outreach to people who can't get to them, and why there should be guidelines for care that generalists can easily access.
And we still have your algorithms, right?
And there should be some new ones coming in the next 6 months or so, I hope.
Very good. We can't wait to see those. You write about the fact, in your article, you write about the fact that we do have hope with better news from the PRIDE HD trial, right?
Right. Now, the pridopidine, the drug in the PRIDE HD trial, is a drug that is modulating. It's not decreasing dopamine. It's trying to improve the balance of it in some complicated fashion that I don't have a clue how it works. in some complicated fashion, it tends to balance how dopamine is released or used or impacts the various different nerves. And with any luck, we will have some results and good results pretty soon, so we can... I'm not God, and I'm not going to say that this... And the results won't be there until the fat lady sings. And that may be me, but it won't be for a while. If it's positive, this fat lady will sing.
Yeah, we know that the trial has been closed for a while, so we're waiting for those results, right?
Right. It's been closed.
Yeah.
We have at least another 9 months before the last people are able to complete that year, I believe, or in that range.
Okay.
And then there's analysis. Who knows exactly when we'll know, but hopefully, within a year. If it's before, that would be wonderful. And I hope the fat lady will sing good things.
Well, we're very fortunate to have Teva working on these drugs for us, and they've been so supportive and helpful to the community as well. Did you have any other items that you wanted to touch on this article? I think we covered it, didn't we?
Oh, I think so. Don't use it for, don't use it for a symptom that something else will work for. don't take the chance that it's going to make your disease go faster. If there's another drug that will take care of it adequately.
Very good. Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
For this article. And we need to know these things. And we need to take this information to our physicians as well so that they have that information. Because not every physician that we deal with is a center of excellence expert, you know?
Well, in fact, most aren't.
Yeah,
most of the people
true.
In our country don't see a specialty center physician even once every 2 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Most
and
people
then as time goes on,
with Huntington's in this country.
Yeah.
And as needs increase, there's more difficulty getting to centers.
Right.
There's an interesting thing that I found as I was researching this article that I'm writing. And that is something that makes complete sense to me now, but didn't earlier, is that more people tend to go to centers that are easier to get to. So big places, New York and Chicago, should have a lot more people in their centers than small places like Rochester or South Carolina. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, people with Huntington's have difficulty getting into chaotic, crowded city places. Right?
I like your idea of outreach. Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
I like your idea of outreaching to, the centers outreaching to other clinics and things like that. And that's a really good
and
idea.
That is what Cystic Fibrosis Foundation does, much more than we do. But, of course, it takes money.
Yeah.
And our organizations don't have as much money. I mean, HTSA is very poorly funded compared to, and their centers are much less well funded than our cystic fibrosis centers. And that's because, you know, fundraising is better in cystic fibrosis.
Mm-hmm.
For care.
Now, does cystic fibrosis have the same prevalence almost?
Yes. But, and that's why it's a good model for Huntington's, I believe, or Huntington's care. But it's Huntington's is more difficult to treat because it's harder to get people to their doctor. Mm-hmm. If you have a child with cystic fibrosis, you are going to travel anywhere to get good care for your child, right? You're going to vigorously fundraise as opposed to Huntington's families who are tired, who are burned out. It's a multi-generational thing. It happens most often. Of course, it happens in juveniles, but then that's most tragic of all, but it happens most often in adults. And so and there isn't, you know, why take people to doctors if they're not going to do anything? And I don't think cystic fibrosis certainly now does not have that hanging over their head. There's a lot that can be done for cystic fibrosis.
Right.
And the belief, and there are many things that can be done for Huntington's to improve quality of life, but we just don't believe it, all of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we just don't get to our doctors. And sometimes when we get there, our doctors don't believe they can do anything either. So it's harder. Mm-hmm. It's a harder disease than Huntington's to care for. Each of them are complex and bad, but Huntington's is harder.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we hope that'll improve soon. Well, thank you so much. Let me go over some upcoming shows and events, and then we'll close the show. And Dr. Goodman, thank you so much for joining your 40th episode. Can't believe it's been 40. That's just amazing. So
I'm probably your oldest contributor. Huh? Are you?
No, not at all. But I've enjoyed
for the longest
all of our
time.
I've enjoyed all of our shows together, so please don't stop. So let's see, upcoming shows, October 20. We have attorney Alan A. Pfeffer from New York. He'll be joining us to talk about the death with dignity laws and how it affects people with HD. Actually, our own Governor Jerry Brown of California just signed the Right to Die legislation yesterday, so this should be a very interesting show. Upcoming events, October 21st to 24th is the HSG conference in Tampa, Florida. So go to www.hsglimited.org, find out all about the conference on October 21 to 24. November 7, we have our very own Nick's Run for HD at De Anza Cove at Mission Bay, San Diego. Go to helpforhd.org and click on the events tab to find out more information about that. December 10 through 12, we'll have the World Stem Cell Summit and Regenerative Medicine Capital Conference in Atlanta, Georgia. And January 9, we're already starting our January 2016 events are starting. We have the Florida Police Chiefs Association Conference in Point Verde, Florida, that we'll be attending. We're working with law enforcement now, working on the ground level with them, with their advanced training to give them more information about Huntington's disease individuals, and it's really helping them to understand the disease better. So, Dr. Goodman, thank you again. Stay with me, and we'll chat for a second after the close of the show. And this will conclude our show tonight. And again, everyone, thank you for tuning in. We'll talk to you next week. And don't forget to tell all your colleagues, family, and friends about Help for HD Radio. Visit us on our website, helpforhd.org. Check out Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, Instagram. We're getting in there, too. Good night, everybody. We'll talk soon. Are you there?
I'm here. Yes.
Let me call you because my page is not closing up here. So let me close the show and I'll call you. Okay.
Okay.
Talk to you soon. Good night, everyone. Good.